While we're waiting for a few more people to come in, we can take a few minutes. If any of you have any questions or want to report a little bit how it's going, this is the fourth week of our 5-week introductory course. And we've talked about mindfulness of meditating on the breath, and we've talked about mindfulness of the body, and last week we talked about mindfulness of emotions. So are there any questions about any of that, or anything that seems that you'd like to take the opportunity to discuss? Yes?
I'm noticing how many times during the day that I'm remembering to be mindful and how it changes everything. One thing I always did very fast, or tried to do as fast as I could, was to write checks. And I'd be putting stamps on. I mean, I was like 3 steps ahead from the minute I started writing each check. And it was a very pensive, uncomfortable process. And now what I'm doing is I got a really beautiful pen, and it's like I'm doing penmanship. And I'm just writing them slowly and putting them in a very neat stack and just putting stamps on it. It's just completely changed the whole process.
Noticing that you can have the difference between being present for something in a clear way versus rushing through it and being ahead of yourself.
Yeah, just being there instead of being in the next step with every step.
Beautiful. How many of you have you noticed that? It's a big difference between the two ways of being. I hope you've noticed that. And one of the things it points to is on one hand, there's the practice or the effort made just to slow down or to be really present rather than be ahead of yourself. And but that also requires the motivation to want to do that. And one of the things, the practice itself can be seen as being very, very simple and easy, but sometimes it's the motivation that lags behind, or the motivation isn't so easy to come by. This is something that you really want. Many people are not so sure. I mean, they want it kind of in the abstract. Oh, sure, it's a good idea to be present. But then to really want it enough so it takes some priority in one's life. And it's possible to have something like mindfulness or presence have a primary priority for a person's life, so that it takes precedence over everything else, or everything else that you do somehow has to fit within the context of that. So it doesn't mean you deny anything else, it doesn't mean you stop doing all kinds of other things, but it means that you have some real preference that whatever else you do is going to happen within the field of being present and mindful for it. And the risk is, if we don't, is we lose ourselves in the process. Yes?
I've actually been noticing the opposite, which is being aware of how well after the fact of an event I'm caught in the fog or to overcome it. Emotional.
Fascinating. That's very, very valuable also. They talk sometimes in Buddhism about leaving a residue or leaving traces. And it's possible to live in such a way that we don't leave so many traces or residue of that type, where we're still holding on to some past event and repeating it and reviewing it and holding on to the feelings. And the two things that are helpful to not leave any of those traces is, one is to really be present when something's happening. Because if we're not really present while it's happening, that's when we tend to latch on, and our drivenness, our preoccupations, our attachments, and our fears kind of latch on and develop a certain amount of momentum that carries on into the future. But if we're present, really present for what's going on, we're less likely to do that. We probably still will, but we're less likely to have the same kind of unconscious force. And the other thing is that if you're mindful enough, then the opportunity exists that you can be a clearer channel for your feelings. So, for example, you might be a clearer channel for your anger, if anger was what's going on. Not necessarily that you express the anger to the person you're angry with, but that you're not bottling it up and freezing it, that you really acknowledge it and let it flow within you. And in the context of letting it flow, have a more honest and realistic completion of what's happening in the moment. But what you noticed is great. It's very important what you noticed. That residue that left behind.
I've noticed more flexibility in how I'm living. Sort of more willingness to say, okay, well, I'll try this. If that doesn't work, I'll try something else. And just see how it goes.
Mm.
I'm being less rigid with things.
And what do you attribute that to?
Just taking the time to sit and notice how things are and to see what happens when I notice myself sitting like this, notice myself thinking like that, just being more present to what's going on.
There's the idea of freedom, which is a very important one in Buddhism, is based on the notion that there's choice, some kind of choice, that we can choose how we respond to a situation. And but we don't. The less mindful we are, the less choice we have, the less we see the various options, including not responding at all. And the more mindful we are, I think, the more freedom there can be, because we see the places of choice. And one of the remarkable things will happen as mindfulness practice and mindfulness meditation gets deeper and stronger for a person, increasingly subtle and deep places of choice reveal themselves. There's a tremendous amount of subtle but very powerful decisions we make in our life constantly. And they're often outside of our conscious awareness, because we're either going too fast or racing ahead of ourselves or whatever. But as we start paying more careful attention to the present moment, it opens up and you see hugely increasing range of ways to choose what to do. When I came back from living 3 years in a Zen monastery, where in a sense, a lot of the life was formalized. You ate a certain way, you sat a certain way, you followed a schedule, and everything was kind of set. And so your mindfulness practice developed within kind of this set way of doing things. When I came back to San Francisco to live there, I was highly aware of the number of choices I had to make that had been made for me in the monastery. So, for example, the choice of how I sit in the chair became a big deal. Before I went to the monastery, I never thought about it. I just sat there and kind of slumped, or whatever I did. But we choose the way we choose to sit in the chair. And most of us are living so fast and not paying enough attention to our body and what's going on, that we don't necessarily see the choice that's involved in the way we sit down to a chair. I mean, how many of you thought consciously about the decision you made, how you sat in the chair today, those of you in a chair, coming here now? Some of you. Great. I'm glad. So maybe one more question before we start formally. There's no beginnings. Yes, Michelle.
I wanted to hear something about indecisiveness. It just came to mind when you were talking about this. When you can have suddenly a range of choices.
Uh-huh.
What indecisiveness is.
Well, one of the great choices we have is not to do anything. And actually, that's a powerful thing. Not to do anything in a passive way, but what we can do, the choice we have is not to do anything, and rather but bring mindfulness to the situation, bring awareness to the situation. So the choice, so that's something which is often not, I think, for many people, not considered to be a valid choice, because many of us tend to focus so much on doing and decision making. And paying attention seems rather passive and not doing. But it's actually very, very powerful. And so there's indecision. One of the things you can do is do nothing but bring careful mindfulness to the situation. And with time, maybe something will reveal itself. But indecisiveness is an interesting one, because it can come out of a kind of a natural not knowing what to do. There's different options. It's not clear what to do, you know, what to choose. Or it can be a kind of holding back, a kind of fear. And so then it becomes interesting to explore the sense of holding back. What's holding you back? Is there fear? And what is that fear about? And kind of go underneath below the decisiveness, or the emotion behind the decisiveness, can be a key to understanding what is a deeper issue in the situation. And you can feel, one of the interesting things about mindfulness practice is we try often to turn the experience back into the body. How is it for the body? And indecisiveness can sometimes be very clearly felt in the body as a kind of holding back. And then to hang out with that, feel that in the body very concretely for a while, and then see what happens as you do that. The other interesting opportunity that exists with mindfulness meditation is if you have to make an important decision to sit down and meditate for half an hour or whatever, and don't think about your issue that's come up, but at the end of your meditation period, as you kind of come out of it, kind of ask the question, you know, or just kind of raise the issue and see if in the kind of little bit more silent mind than you usually have, some other answer arises within you. Many of us, if we're kind of spinning constantly on our normal thought patterns, there's only a kind of a certain range of solutions. But if the mind has a chance to calm down a little bit, sometimes a deeper solution will come. And this is a common phenomenon. Some people will go jogging or running, and they find that's a time for creative, unintentional decision making. Okay, last one.
I just saw an accident on the way down, and it's like I can't just get that scene out of my mind. It's like I'm in a dream kind of
movie.
Yeah. Talk, and it's just like.
Well, maybe you're not supposed to get it out of your mind quickly.
Yeah.
So one of the things we do then, when there's something strong experience like that, that becomes a place that you bring your presence. And if something so powerful as that, I think it's natural not to listen to a speaker so carefully, unless I did something really dramatic to override it. And so you need to honor, really be mindful of the situation and maybe the tension you feel between trying to listen to me and the pull of the image you have. And you might decide that the place it's important for you to attend to is the feelings and image that's inside of you concerning this accident. And just tune me out for a little while and just be with that fully. If that makes sense. And just process it. Let your inner life process it by bringing your presence to it. If you continue to struggle and don't really want to be there, and you don't want to listen to me, eventually it'll kind of pass from your consciousness, but it might not be fully processed. But if you kind of bring your full attention just to bear on that and be with your feelings and your sensations, then maybe in a deeper way you can process it. Also, you might begin to develop some understanding of what goes on. Some of the power of a situation like that, some of it might exist in the nature of the situation itself. And there's empathy there, feeling for someone in distress or hurt or maybe perhaps, you don't know. And there's kind of empathy, concern perhaps, but there can be a lot of other things that get added onto it. I can imagine some people would have a tremendous aversion to any kind of suffering in the world. And so to see some concrete situation of suffering out there, there's more than just empathy. There's recoiling in one's own heart because of this fear about any contact with the world's suffering. And it's that recoiling, that fear, that carries the momentum through time. And so by bringing careful mindfulness, non-judgmental mindfulness to how you actually are in the moment, you might be able to start distinguishing between what is in the nature of the situation, the event, the feelings you have from it, and what is the extra stuff that gets added on because we identify with it or we recoil from it or we judge it or something. Does that make sense? And what's beautiful about mindfulness practice is that the intention always is to be non-judgmental about what you notice. There's nothing that mindfulness reveals that needs to be judged negatively. Just sitting there, just being present for yourself, and not deciding to do anything, just kind of being there for what arises within you. You can allow it to all aspects of yourself to be there without any necessity to judge it negatively or positively. Tremendous feelings of rage and murderous rage, you want to kind of strangle someone, arises as you sit. Great. You know, you just let it come. In the context of sitting quietly like this. You just really feel it. There's no need to judge it. The point is to feel it. Great experiences of ecstasy arise. And there's no need to hold on to it or justify it or, you know, just allow it to come and just in the non-judgmental field of awareness. I hope that addressed your concern. You might have tuned me out appropriately. I said that early on, and then I went on and on. So reminds me of a story, a Zen story, of these two Zen monks traveling through China, and they came to a somewhat shallow river that there was no bridge, and there was a young woman there who couldn't get across, and so one of the monks picked up the woman and carried her across the other side and put her down, and then the two monks continued on their travels. Now it happens that traditionally in Buddhism there's fairly strict rules about monks not having any physical contact with women. So he'd broken one of the serious rules of a monk. So anyway, these two monks continued their journey, and when they came to a monastery to spend the night there later in the day, just before they got through the gate of the monastery, the one monk turned to the other and said, "How could you have picked up that woman at the river? You're a monk and you took these vows of commitment to, you know, not do such things, you know, and how could you have broken those rules? And how could you? I don't understand. How could you?" And the second monk said to the first, "I put down that woman at the river. Why are you still carrying her?" So how do we carry things in our mind and our feelings in our body? We carry things along with time. Today, the instructions is going to be about thoughts, about how to include thinking as part of mindfulness practice. I think it's important to wait 4 weeks before we talk about it, because many of us in our culture, in our life here, are excessively thoughtful. It's caught up in our thoughts. Most of us live, the center of gravity of our life is our thoughts and our thinking. And we live preoccupied, swimming around in it. The Tibetan teacher Chögyam Trungpa once said, "The epitome of the human condition is one big traffic jam of discursive thought." Anyway, many of us are kind of lost in our thoughts. It's where we kind of center of gravity of our life is. And for many of us, we end up being imbalanced because of it. So if we talk about thoughts in the first week, then it just lends itself to more thinking. And of course, by the fourth week now, you're all ready to hear that. Without getting too discursive about it. And I'll start the instructions on thought by telling you the story I often say that was very helpful for me. Was some years ago, I was watching football with some friends. Actually, they were Vipassana teachers, meditation teachers. And one of them had the remote control in his power. And as sensible people do, I believe, when the commercials came on, he would turn off the sound, and then we'd have a conversation. And then, now what was odd was at some point, you seemingly most sensible people, when the game comes on again, you turn the sound on, right? Well, my friend didn't do that. But we all knew the game was on. We stopped talking, started watching. There was no sound. And since he was a meditation teacher, I thought, well, and he's supposed to be very mindful, I thought, well, this is rather interesting. So rather than, screaming at him or, you know, saying, "Hey, you," I thought, well, let's just see what's going on here. Let's just be present for this situation. So I sat there for a while just watching the football game without any sound. And eventually he turned the sound on. And what struck me was the great difference between watching the game with the sound and without the sound. Without the sound, there was no commentary. There was no commentator, sports commentary, telling you kind of what was going on, blow by blow. And I could kind of more or less follow the game. You know, I kind of know what happened. And these guys get up, they stand facing each other, they crashed into each other, and one of the people maybe has the ball and he runs a few yards down the field, and it's kind of great. And sometimes someone catches the ball and they go a little bit further. You can kind of watch them. They go, they make it to the 50-yard line and the 40-yard line. You realize he might make it all the way, and 30-yard line. And you see this guy coming kind of after him. And he catches up to him. Well, it looks like he's not going to make it. And he tackles him on the 10-yard line. And it's fine. Now, when you turn on the sound, and the same situation goes on, there's this guy telling you, oh my God, he's on the 50-yard line, he's going to 40, oh my God, he's going to make, oh, there's this coming at this guy out of the left field, and he's going to... And I'm on my edge of my chair, and it's all exciting, and you know, I'm out of breath, and finally I'm just, he gets caught, and I'm just drained. Wow. It's rather traumatic. There's a difference between, you know, the experience of watching a football game with the sports commentator and without. And the job of the sports commentator, in a sense, is to get you into the game and involved, even emotionally. And the game's a lot calmer without it. I'm not saying that you should not have a commentator. It's kind of fun that has those emotions. But what happens to many of us is that we don't see the difference between the actual game and what the commentator is doing. And the commentator has very little to do with the game itself. It's someone external to the game making comments about it. But often because of the way we kind of receive it all, we integrate it into one. And so the emotion that we're picking up from the commentator becomes for us the experience of the game itself. Something like that. Now this is what happens to us all the time in our own minds. We have our own sports commentator, news commentator, talk coach in our own minds that's constantly commentating about what's going on around us or within us. And often our commentary of what's going on within us and around us is somewhat removed from actually what's going on, in the same way that the game is different from the sports commentator. But we don't see that, the difference. And so these two things get entangled. And so we end up living in the... we tend to live our life through the commentary rather than experiencing it directly. So, for example, what's a good example? A meditation example would be, you're sitting here and you have a itch on your big toe. And the commentator says, oh my God, I wonder if it's skin cancer. And then, oh my God, you know, it happened, you know, that, you know, I remember this person, and this person had, you know, some kind of great infection on their big toe, and it was awful, and maybe I have the same infection, and maybe I'm contagious, and hopefully no one notices, and this is really embarrassing, and maybe I should take off my socks and look, but then I'm in a meditation group, and I shouldn't, you know. And there's all this commentating going on, right? And we get lost in that world. And we don't see that the world of the commentary is very different from the experience of the itch itself. It might be nothing at all. It might just be an itch. Nothing more than that. But we got lost in this world of other things. One of the great things that's very helpful in meditation practice is just learning to distinguish between when we are seeing the world or living the world through or in the commentary and when we can experience it more directly. And it isn't that one is better than the other exactly, but it's very useful to see the difference. And if we can see the difference, then we can have the choice to rest or bring our presence more fully into our direct experience as it's lived, rather than being lost in the commentary and ideas and judgments that we might have. So you're sitting here and you're following your breath, and the breath feels a certain way. It feels just a tightness in the chest as you breathe in, and as you breathe out, you don't feel like you can really breathe out fully. And you feel this over and over, you feel this rhythm, and then your mind wanders away, and it's kind of uncomfortable to be there, so you don't want to... Often when things are uncomfortable, we kind of try to run away from it, so we're not really there, and we come back, and it's hard to be there, but, you know, it's kind of like we keep coming back, and we feel it, the breath. And that's kind of how it is. The commentary says, oh my God, I'm a terrible meditator, I'm not doing this right, my mind keeps wandering away, there's all this constriction in my chest. How can I have done this myself? How can I have lived my life so I was always so stressed out and so worried and so uptight? I must be really uptight. And so it goes. And it goes on and on, the commentary. And the commentary is our judgment evaluation about something which doesn't have to be judged. It just, oh, there's tightness in the chest and the out-breath doesn't go fully and the mind wanders away, but then you bring it back. You can leave it that simply in the realm of presence, of direct experience. Does that make sense? So as we're going to start sitting, we're going to do a little sitting now, but as we sit, one of the things you might pay a little bit of attention to is when you tend to drift off into the commentary and rest there versus when you can rest more with your breath itself or in your physical experience. And it isn't that you have to stop having the commentary, But choose, if you can, to stay with simplicity of the direct experience. Put most of your center of gravity, put most of the weight of your presence there, and let the thoughts kind of be in the background, if you can. So, taking a comfortable but alert posture, sitting with a little bit of energy or aliveness in the spine if you can. And then gently close your eyes. And then in the beginning of a sitting, it's often nice to take two or three deep breaths, connecting to the inside of the body as you breathe in, relaxing into yourself as you breathe out. And then letting your breath breathe itself whatever way it wants. You might take a few moments also to look through the body and see if there's any place, obvious muscles that can be relaxed or softened a little. You might soften the forehead and the eyes. Sometimes the eyes can be a little bit more restful. If you let your eyes, in a sense, look inward and then let them relax. Sometimes it's useful to soften the jaws. And sometimes it's possible to relax the shoulders a little. And then finally, it's quite useful to relax the stomach, to let the stomach hang out, soften the stomach. And then let your attention, your awareness, become open or become aware of your breathing. And the way to be aware of your breathing is to feel it as sensation. Not to think about the breath, but to experience it the way the body experiences its breathing. The expansion, perhaps, as you breathe in. The movement, the pressure. The release as you breathe out. The warmth and the coolness of the air, perhaps. Feeling the breath at the sensory level. In a sense, it's a sensory awareness exercise. Sensing the breath. And you might find it helpful to very, very softly whisper in the mind, label or name the breath as you breathe, as a way of guaranteeing that you stay present for it. So you can label the in-breath in, the out-breath out. Or if mostly you're feeling the arising and falling of the chest or the abdomen, you can do the in-breath as rising, the out-breath as falling. Whenever your mind wanders off into thought or gets caught up in the commentary, simply in a very simple way, notice that that's happened, and then without any judgment, wake up again to the sensations of breathing, letting yourself be awake with the full experience of breathing in, the full experience of breathing out. whenever you can remember, coming back to the simplicity of breathing. Any ideas that you have of something you're going to accomplish, or something that's supposed to happen, or something you want to change, or any judgment about how it's going, all that is commentary and is unnecessary. It's possible just to be present for the way things are. No need for anything to change. Just this particular breath, and then the next one, and then the next one. As you feel your breathing, as you feel the in-breath and feel the out-breath, notice which one is clearest to your awareness. Is the in-breath clearest or the out-breath clearest? Phase of the breath which is least clear, that's the place where you're most likely to wander off into thought. If, for example, the out-breath is not so clear, or the end of the out-breath is not so clear, the lack of strong sensation means that the mind is less likely to stay put there and is more likely to wander off into thought. So if you notice this phenomena, that just part of your breath cycle is less clear than any other, just softly remind yourself to stay present to get through that particular part of the cycle until stronger sensations become evident again. when you find yourself caught up in thoughts, you can perhaps become aware of the power of compulsion. Perhaps you become aware of the power or the energy of wanting to think, or the pull, the tremendous pull we have sometimes to get involved in certain ideas. Sometimes we just softly float into thinking about something, and sometimes we're grabbed or pulled, or we reach out for it. In the non-discursive field of awareness, you might also note the impulse, the feeling of that impulse to be involved in thoughts, allowing it to be there in the spaciousness of mind. One of the ideas that can occur to people who meditate is that in meditation, the mind is supposed to be silent. There's not supposed to be any thoughts. And the goal of meditation is to get to such a mind, to have a very still, thoughtless kind of mind. And there's two interesting things about that. One is that when we have that idea and we're caught up in that idea, then we're caught up in the commentary. And the other interesting thing about that is that it's an idea that tends to cause suffering, because I think it's unreasonable in most circumstances to have a mind which is silent, that doesn't have any thoughts at all. It's not the purpose of Buddhist mindfulness meditation to make the mind completely silent and empty of thoughts. Rather, the point, in a sense, is to not to be caught by our thoughts, not to be bothered by our thoughts, not to be preoccupied with them, or not to be driven by them. But you want to be very careful with this idea that the point is to have a silent mind, because that's not really the point. And it's unrealistic to expect it for most of us. Occasionally it might happen. We might drop into a place like that. The point of mindfulness, as I keep saying, mindfulness practice, is very simply, is not to change our experience, but rather to wake up to what our experience is, to bring presence to what our experience is. So if what's happening is a lot of thought is happening, then the practice is not to get rid of the thoughts or some better way of being, but rather to wake up fully to the fact that we're thinking. And that's what we do in mindfulness practice. Now the power of that is that when we wake up, wakefulness, being awake to something, ways in which we can get preoccupied or identified or attached or concerned or apprehensive around the kind of thoughts we're having. if we aren't caught up in them, if we're not preoccupied with them, then the thoughts will tend not to have such powerful drives to kind of go on and on in circles and circles and circles. We fuel our thinking by our preoccupations and our emotional involvement with them. And if we're not fueling them, thoughts will kind of be like, almost like bubbles. They'll kind of arise peacefully, like clouds in an empty sky, is the analogy that they give in Buddhism. And they arise, and they kind of dissolve, and then another one might arise, and they dissolve. I call this thoughting, as opposed to thinking. Thinking, as in this way I'm defining it, is when we, but because we get caught up in and preoccupied, we form a chain of associated thinking that drives itself almost. But we don't have to be caught up. It's possible to allow a thought to arise by itself. Now, wakefulness, being awake to the fact that we're thinking, being awake to the fact that the mind is busy and chattering away at 1,000 miles an hour, that wakefulness is not a caught-upness. And in the degree in which wakefulness is not a caught-upness, it doesn't perpetuate, it doesn't keep fueling the caught-upness. And so there's kind of more room, in a sense, for us to be present. And in that room, things begin to find their own balance. But when we're completely tied up in knots around our thoughts and our concerns about yesterday or tomorrow, and there's very little room in there, there's no room for things to relax in their own natural way if they want to relax. We keep fueling them and adding to them. So part of the function of awareness practice, of wakefulness practice, is in a sense, is not to get rid of anything, but to kind of, in a sense, create more room for their existence. And we make room in the room of awareness, and then see what happens. So that's equally true of thoughts as it is of the breath. Now, the basic practice of mindfulness is to bring careful attention, careful wakefulness, to whatever is the strongest experience you're having in the present moment. So it isn't so much that we open to everything randomly all at once, but we open to whatever wants to present itself to us. And we know that by what is the strongest experience in the present moment for us. And then we bring our careful attention to that. That's kind of the basic practice. But because it's somewhat difficult for us to kind of be really present for life as it reveals itself to us, we use the breath as an anchor, as a place to train ourselves to come into the present and be more present. So when we do mindfulness meditation, we give a preference to stay present for the breath. I choose the word preference carefully because it's not a compulsion, it's not a demand, it's not an expectation, it's not a striving to do so. But it's kind of like a little extra kind of gentle effort to try to stay there with the breath than you would normally would otherwise. And then if the mind wanders away, kind of casually wanders off into thoughts, then we simply come back to the breath and stay there with the breath. If something else arises in our experience which is more compelling than the breath, that is stronger than our kind of preference for the breath is there, then the practice is to let go of the breath and make that particular strong experience the meditation. So if the knee hurts as you meditate, and the knee pain becomes stronger than your kind of ability to be with the breath in a nice way, then you let go of the breath and the knee pain becomes the meditation, as I talked about the first day. Or it can be very pleasant physical sensations also. If they're strong enough, they become the meditation. And what that means is that we don't think about it more, but rather we bring this ability to have non-discursive kind of insight or awareness or seeing of the experience, in and of feeling the experience in and of itself. And we want to feel it very carefully. Feel that sense of tension or strain in the knee very carefully, to bring very careful and close attention to it. And we give it lots of room as we kind of bring ourselves closer to it. If a sound arises and the sound is stronger than our ability to be with the breath or whatever else we're paying attention to, rather than thinking of the sound as being a distraction, the sound is just the new subject of meditation. And if the sound is really strong, then you're being told, now it's time to do listening meditation. And you just bring your full attention as you can, best you can, to listening to that wonderful owl, whatever it is. And you do listening. You can very quietly name the experience listening as a way of helping you kind of stay open for it, so the mind doesn't casually wander off into some kind of thought or commentary. And when the strong sound is finally passed, and sometimes it might be a long time. I remember when I was in Thailand, in a little cabin next to a farmer's field, and they decided to put in a irrigation ditch behind the little cabin. And not only, so for a long time it was listening meditation. This bulldozer was kind of... And then after a while it was shaking meditation as the ground shook. And that was just a meditation, you know. And I could have easily had the idea, oh, this is not really what meditation is all about. Meditation is about being with the breath and about becoming, having certain kinds of experience. Again, that's the ideas we have. And our ideas are very different from what's actually happening in the present moment. The point of Buddhist meditation is to be with... This is a kind of a famous, very famous cliche line in Buddhism. To be with the way things are. In Buddhism, they're very, very interested in the way things are, not in the ways we think they should be. So if I have this idea, oh, meditation is not supposed to be about listening to some bulldozer. Well, the bulldozer is what's happening. So that's what it is. That's what life is about. And then I can have this thought. Then I can say, well, this is really unpleasant. And I don't think I want to. I think I'm going to think about Tahiti. And that's more pleasant. And I deserve more pleasure in my life. So I'm going to think about Tahiti. That's turning away. Or I might kind of sit there and say, well, I hate bulldozers. And start planning all the ways I'm going to blow them up. We have various strategies, almost innately sometimes, of dealing with things we're not comfortable with. And sometimes one of the ways of strategizing is very much in the desire direction, like thinking about something, fantasizing about something really desirable. The other way is to go in the aversion direction. But there's still strategies that keep us from being present for the way things actually are. So the practice, in a sense, is try to be very simple, to be with the breath, and then when something else becomes stronger, to let go of the breath and let that become the meditation. If a strong emotion arises, as we talked about last week, that becomes the meditation. You feel your anger, feel your joy fully. And again, noticing when you get involved in the commentary, it's very important with emotions to see a difference between your commentary and the actual experience of heat and energy and tightness in your body as the emotion shows up. And your commentary is justifications for the anger, the fears about it, the embarrassment, the judgments, the evaluations, the stories related to it. Notice when your center of gravity goes off into there and you lose touch with actually what's happening physically in your real lived experience. So if an emotion becomes strong, we try to feel it as lived experience in the present moment. And that becomes the meditation. When thoughts arise and they become predominant, if thoughts are in the background, and mostly you can kind of stay with the breath or stay with your body, or you can just leave the thoughts in the background and not worry about them. But sooner or later, you'll notice that the thoughts come into the foreground. And sometimes you just kind of casually kind of wander off into a thought. At that point, if you just kind of casually, you can come back to the breath. But sometimes there's more involvement with the thought. We're not just thoughting, we're thinking, as I defined it. And we're really involved. Then the practice is just to be awake to the fact that you're thinking. And you can actually kind of turn, in a sense, your awareness towards the event of thinking. And with some allowing some room there for that event to be there, just be aware of thinking. And you might say quietly to yourself, thinking, thinking. Just kind of crawl quietly, be fully aware this is what's going on. Thinking, thinking. If it's relatively mild, the involvement with the thoughts, then that kind of space that mindfulness, awareness brings enough non-identification, non-involvement, that it kind of balances or cancels out the way we're caught up in it. And then naturally the thought will kind of dissolve itself. We're not trying to get rid of it or stop it. It'll kind of go by itself. Sometimes thoughts are more compelling or they're more compulsive than our thinking is. And then we want to kind of, again, bring our attention fully to it, kind of look the thought head on and be aware of the event of thinking. And sometimes, if it's really strong, the compulsion to think, you might name it a little bit more exactly. So rather than just thinking, thinking, you can name it remembering, or planning, or fantasizing, or whatever you know your pattern is. And sometimes, when we're a little bit more exact with the name, that tends to kind of create more room for it and less identification, and it might release itself a little bit easier. But the point of meditation is not to release the thoughts, even though it sounds like that's what I'm saying. The point is not to have it release. The point is to bring wakefulness to what's happening And what I'm doing now is describing what might happen when you bring wakefulness to it. And it might dissolve. If it's mild, the involvement, it'll dissolve quicker. If it's stronger, it takes more presence for it to dissolve. But the point is not to make it dissolve. The point is to bring awareness to it. See, that's an important point. And what we're interested in is the event of thinking. We're not really interested in the content of the thoughts. The content of thinking, for the point of view of mindful meditation, is not particularly important. Now, sometimes thoughts are really compulsive, really kind of a lot of energy there, really wrapped up in discursive thought. When that's the case, there are one of the most useful things I know to do is to become aware of the physical manifestation of that kind of compulsive thinking. If the thinking is that strong that you're really kind of wrapped up in it, almost certainly there's going to be some kind of energetic experience of that thinking in your body. You know, many of us frown if we think really intensely, right? Well, if you pay attention, you can actually feel the tension in your frown. If sometimes we get a headache when we think too much, or there's all kinds of experiences, because energetically the jaw gets tight, perhaps, or the shoulders tense up a little bit, or you feel a lot of pressure in the head, or a band of pressure maybe around the forehead, or you feel like there's 10,000 bumblebees kind of spinning out of control inside of your head. There's some energetics that all that thinking kind of gives itself to you. You might feel drained or exhausted from just on and on, this onslaught of thoughts. So rather than kind of bringing your attention to the content of that thinking, you can bring your awareness to the energetics in the body, what it feels like to be involved in all that thinking. And just hang out with that, be with that. And it's very healing to bring awareness to that kind of compulsion. It's kind of like you make a lot of room and space then, and in that room and space, as I keep saying, it has a chance to kind of process itself and relax. So again, it's kind of similar to the instructions for emotions. You feel it the way it's experienced in the body, and then hang out there for however long it's there. It doesn't matter how long it's there. If it's there for an hour, you just be there for the physical sensation in the body. The other interesting thing to do with thoughts is if they're really compulsive, going on and on and on, if you keep coming back to the breath and you go off again into some kind of thought, and you notice you keep going off in the same theme over and over again, like if you're constantly planning or constantly thinking in the past, then almost certainly that kind of repetitive thoughts is fueled by an emotion. And then what you can do is you can turn your attention back and try to discern what the emotion is that seems to be connected or intertwined with that particular preoccupation. So for example, some people who plan a lot, if you notice a constant planning in your meditation, you might also notice, you might not, but you might notice that there's a fear connected to that planning. And it's the fear that's fueling that preoccupation. And if then what we do then is we bring our attention and attend to the experience of fear in our body. It's almost like the planning thoughts are a little flag that goes up and says, "Hey, you dummy, pay attention to me." And until you pay attention to the fear is going to keep putting up these kind of flags saying, "Pay attention to me, you know, plan away." But always the point in this mindfulness practice is not to try to create change or make anything happen, but rather in a very simple way, to try to bring this wakeful quality to whatever is happening in our experience. And when it's thoughts, we kind of become aware of that, hopefully without too much judgment. But when there is judgment, those kinds of thoughts, then we try to allow that to be with lots of room. In that sense, the mindfulness practice is very forgiving. Because even when you don't do it right, it's fine. So that was a lot of instruction. How does that sit with you? Do you want to ask some questions or make some comments?
How do you discern the emotions behind the thoughts without engaging in thinking itself?
You can feel. Feel in your body. Have you ever been really angry at someone? And has that strong anger ever fueled kind of compulsive thoughts about the situation? And you're kind of consumed with the thoughts At that moment, if you feel the body, how do you think that anger feels in your body?
Tension.
And how do you experience that tension? How can you know that tension? But it isn't that you're thinking and trying to figure out, you know, that you're anger, but you can just feel it directly as tension, right? So in the same way. So it isn't that you have to think, you know, what is it, you know, and then kind of figure out what it is. It's more like, well, let me see here. If I open up and just feel my body right now, what will show itself? And what emotion might show itself in the feelings? And if nothing shows itself, then don't worry about it. Think, you know, continue being mindful of planning. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I have a lot of trouble with meditating on thinking because it's hard for me to just let the thoughts be. Anything else is relatively easy, like an outside sound or a bodily sensation or even emotion. I can sit there and just let it be. But thinking, it's like the moment I realize that I'm thinking, I want to change it.
Uh-huh.
I have a lot of trouble just sort of letting it be there while I'm watching it.
Well, there's two things I maybe recommend. One is the difficulty you have with allowing it to be, that represents some involvement. And what you might do is kind of look around and try to, or sense around, what is that extra, and it's extra. What does that involvement feel like for you? And you might find there's identification or fear or something that goes on there. And if you can discern what that extra thing is, you might be able to find some freedom around your thoughts. That's one thing you might do. The other thing you might do, if you because you've mindfully noticed this difficulty you have, you might, to balance a strong tendency to get caught up in your thoughts, is don't do much mindfulness of thinking when thoughts come up and they're strong. Just come back to the breath. And just be a little bit more diligent to really create some strength of concentration to be with the breath. And the stronger your ability to be mindful and concentrate on the breath is, the more it tends to override the tendency to get preoccupied in the thoughts. And for you, it might be useful to spend maybe 3-4 months, maybe, just not doing mindfulness of thinking at all, but really cultivating that ability to stay with the breath, to develop a strong mindfulness that's stronger than the tendency to get caught in the thoughts. Yes?
Sometimes I'll find that I'm having a conflict or having a problem, and I'll be recycling thoughts, the same thoughts, maybe trying to figure out or something. How do I give awareness to that without getting caught up in it?
When you feel this conflict, how do you feel in your body? Great. What do you think would happen if you brought your attention to the grinding stomach and just hung out there for 20 minutes? And two things might happen. One is that you develop some. And what you're doing, you keep coming back to that, the tight feeling in your body. And as you do that, you're beginning to develop a stronger a mindfulness, a bit stronger than the power of preoccupation. So that's useful. The other thing is, as you feel your tension there and create room for it, allow it to be there, it'll probably begin to soften. And as it begins to soften, the sense of tension around the conflict will also begin to dissolve, and the tendency to be preoccupied about a problem might begin to dissolve. You might still be left with a problem, but you're not tense about it.
That seems more giving awareness to the body than the thoughts.
Yes, that is one thing I'm suggesting. We have a very strong tendency in the West to split the mind from the body. And we often think then that thoughts or emotions are very different from our physical experience, like they're two separate realms. And the Buddhist understanding is more that these things are arise together as a unit. They're inseparable from each other. That we're a psychophysical being, and you can linguistically kind of separate the two, but in our experience they're not so separate. So the physical side of our experience is as much part of that experience as the mental side. So it's a way of opening to the experience that's really very direct, that has an added benefit that we're less likely then to get lost in the story. So it's a fine thing to do. It's a wonderful thing to do. And that as your ability to kind of, as your mindfulness concentration gets stronger with time, then with time you'll actually have, like I told you, you'll be able to have, it's easier to bring full mindfulness to thoughts and allow them to be there, allow them to be there like clouds in an endless sky, drifting about without you doing anything to them. But many of us have this great, also many of us have this great imbalance, as I kept saying in the beginning, we're so much in our thoughts that coming to the physical half of our experience is a wonderful training to create a more balanced sense of being in the world.
What about with my nature of my work? Oftentimes, I really need to be in my head figuring something out.
Yes.
And I guess, I mean, you know, the question is, so how do you, and so I guess what I'm saying is sometimes it's hard for me to turn that off sometimes, because yes, it's important that I figure something out and run it through my head.
Sure.
Five different ways in order to figure it out.
Sure.
Can't really do anything to figure it out, so.
So one of the things to say about that, that's often true, but if you have a regular, steady meditation practice where you don't have to figure anything out in meditation, that you're developing a mind which then becomes freer, where it becomes freer from compulsion. And so then when you have to think about stuff, then it doesn't reinforce the compulsive kind of thinking we have. And slowly, by osmosis, in a sense, the ability to have a freer mind in meditation will begin kind of seeping into your daily life too. The other thing that's very useful for people who have to spend a lot of time at the computer, for example, a lot of time thinking, is to pay some kind of general sense of attention to your posture. So rather than bring mindfulness to your awareness, bring intention to your posture. So when you sit down, you sit in a way that has an alert or wakeful posture to what you do. And that awake posture will actually help a lot to bring balance in life. So for example, if you sit in a way that's aligned and balanced, then when your mind gets caught up in your thoughts, you might notice that because you start slumping over or getting tight or crossing your legs in, you know, triple times. And that becomes an indication that you're caught. And then if you kind of unwind your legs and sit in a kind of balanced way again, you'll find that you're less likely to be so caught up. There's a tremendous correlation between what we do in our body. This is what we say, you know, the body and mind are not so different. And there's a tremendous correlation to what happens in the body and what happens in the mind. And it goes in both directions, that if your mind gets kind of caught up in a certain way, it gets translated into what happens in the body. I pay attention sometimes to my hands, because when I get nervous or get anxious about something, my hands get very active. And if I stop moving my hands a lot, then I find I get calmer almost immediately. So it goes in both directions. And so if you start paying attention to your posture as you work, and then when you notice you have a kind of poor posture, take a better posture, you might find that it brings more balance to you, easier. I remember many years ago, I was a college student, and I got very depressed. And I came home, and I was feeling pretty much sorry for myself. Which, feeling sorry for myself is bad enough to be depressed. But feeling sorry for myself was the commentary, right? The commentator was active. I mean, he was being paid overtime, you know. And so I just kind of laid, I kind of, I didn't lay down lengthwise on the couch. I laid kind of perpendicular, kind of like, so my body was kind of jetted out into the living room, and like my head was in the, you know, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but I was really slouching. All-time sloucher. I couldn't slouch more, still call it slouching. And I noticed, so at some point I noticed that I was doing this. And I noticed I was very depressed. And it occurred to me, what would happen if I sat up straight? So I sat up straight, kind of more or less straight, you know, right on the couch. And immediately the depression went away. That, I thought, was very interesting. Now, probably the depression wasn't very strong. I mean, there are powerful depressions that can kind of take over a person's life, so it's not that easy, usually. But there's a tremendous correlation between our body and our posture and our inner life. And for those of you who do a lot of mental work, you might experiment with giving more attention to a good posture as you work. Yes?
When I'm tired after work and I hit very often fall asleep and kind of like keel over and then I sit up again, and it's really hard. And what I notice is that really when I get away from thinking, it's actually really an indication for me that I'm still thinking when I start falling asleep, and it's probably just from being so tired from thinking all day long, you know. When I get into breathing really and being with my breath, then I'm not tired anymore, and it's very sudden, suddenly very clear.
So you fall asleep for a little while, then at some point you clear out, then your meditation, you wake up.
Yeah, and I'm not tired.
I know that when I used to work at the restaurant, I would come home from the end of the day and be exhausted and tired, and I'd spend the first 20 minutes of meditation like this. And then, the second 20 minutes of meditation, I was completely awake. It was like it wasn't so much I completely fell asleep, but I was just like processing this sleepiness and this tiredness, and after 20 minutes it had processed, and then I kind of woke up. For many of us, some of us, a few of us, you decide. Various ways we have of thinking act like caffeine for the soul, and it keeps us energized and up, you know, energetically up and involved and engaged, and it can override our natural tiredness. And it can exhaust us in the process in the long term. And we kind of keeps us up. It keeps us kind of involved and going and going and going and going. And I call it the caffeine of the soul. And just as when you stop drinking coffee, there's a withdrawal period. So in meditation, sometimes when you give up the caffeine of thinking, there can be actually some symptoms of withdrawal that maybe aren't so pleasant for a while. And just like we put up with it when we go off coffee, I imagine, as we do. So we put up with it as we do the meditation practice. Last question, yes?
Maybe that's what I was experiencing. I was focusing on my breath, and then all of a sudden I became very aware of my heartbeat, and it's like I could feel my heart beating, and I could just feel my whole body, and I don't know if I've ever been that still to feel that, but it was very uncomfortable. It was like I didn't like being that in touch with my body, and I just quickly wanted to go right back up into my head, much more comfortable.
Yes.
Really, it's just this very scary. I don't want to be part of this body.
Absolutely, I can really well imagine that. It's not an unusual experience you're having. Mm-hmm. But in the process of doing that, you begin being with how things really are for you in a deeper way, the undercurrents of your life. And as you do that, you find out more what runs your life in a conscious way. And also you begin to allow yourself to process that or to release it and to find a more balanced, caffeine-free life. But it takes a while, and it might mean facing actually some very difficult things for a while. Some people, tremendous fear might arise. And so hopefully my telling you this might happen gives you enough reassurance that's useful to go through it. So let's sit again.